Well, turn back, will you, to Acts chapter 28. We're back in our series in Acts, soon to finish, as we draw to the end of the book. Our title this morning is Misconceptions on Malta, or Melita as it was called in those days, but Malta as it is today. It's a bit of a strange incident, this, really, isn't it? Verses 1 to 10. You might think it's a bit odd and not very much to teach us. But it does speak to us of all kinds of things, and it's got lessons for us to learn, this little passage. And there are people in the world today that think that these verses are very formative for us today, and we need to just address that for a few minutes as well. So there's a number of things we can pull out of this passage, I think, as we look to God to speak to us through his word today, as we seek every week. I haven't heard many passages or many messages on this particular chapter. The couple that I have heard about have focused on the end of verse 2. Been a message there about that phrase, because it was raining and cold. A message all about the fact that sometimes it's sunny and sometimes it isn't, and that life goes on even when we're in the midst of a storm and it rains and it's sometimes cold, but we must go on and the grace of God keeps us. And that's certainly true, isn't it? Maybe 2007 will be a great year for you, and maybe it won't. Maybe in a year's time, when you're looking back, you will say of the year ahead, it really rained a lot and it was very cold in my life. And if that is so, it doesn't mean that the grace of God has abandoned you. It didn't abandon the Apostle Paul. So that is true. There's been another sermon preached on verse 3, how Paul gathered a pile of brushwood for the fire, and how that great leaders and preachers and apostles and those who want to be great in the kingdom of God need to also do the menial things and gather wood for the fire and to not be afraid to do that. And if you want to be a leader, you must first be a servant. And of course, that is also true. That's not really what this passage is all about. Really, this passage, these 10 verses, are about the interactions with the islanders, with the people on Malta. Here's a new community reached by the gospel because of this shipwreck. We've no evidence before this moment of the gospel reaching Malta. It may have already happened. There may have been other traveling preachers or missionaries or even apostles that have gone. But we don't know about it. There's nothing recorded. This, as far as we know, is the first arrival of the gospel, and the Apostle Paul and other believers, Luke certainly is writing this account, and maybe others on the ship who have taken the gospel there to Malta. The passage mentions natives, doesn't it? The verse, the NIV calls, verse 2 calls them the islanders, but that's kind of a bit of a posh description of what the word might be, the islanders. Some other translations call them the natives. Or the native people. Literally, it's the barbarians, those kind of people that don't speak those cultured languages. You know, the Greeks felt that people that didn't speak their language and weren't cultured like they were all kind of barbarians. They were kind of outside the pale. That was the Greek view. And that's the phrase we've got here. Luke, who's writing, he's a kind guy. He's a doctor. But he says the barbarians showed us unusual kindness. See, it's a play on words. Those people, these kind of natives that we'd never met before, that didn't speak our language, that we were a little bit afraid of in case they ate us alive and put us in their cauldron. Well, those people, they actually showed us unusual kindness. He says, well, don't think of them as natives, as savages, as cannibals. They weren't that at all, says Luke. They actually were really kind to us. They were warm people. They were strangers, but they were warm. They were hospitable, not only to Paul, but to all the shipwrecked travellers. They treated us really well. We stayed there for 3 months. We know that from verse 11. And throughout that 3 months, they were really generous to us. They fed them. They built them a fire. They took them in. They gave them all they needed. Bear in mind, 276 people. That's a lot of people. You know, sometimes on the A1, you stop at various service stations, and if it's just a tiny little chef, sometimes you see this kind of big sign, don't you? No coaches allowed, you know? Because 53 people on a coach, well, that's going to flood the restaurant, and they can't deal with 53. That's just too many. And then you go to a big service station where there's hundreds of seats, and it says, coaches welcome, because they want your money. And they're very happy. But imagine 276 people standing on your beach. If you're just a little community, that's a lot of mouths to feed. But they took them in. And they were really kind. And for the whole of the 3 months, they fed them. They even had, according to verse 7, they even had 3 days at the home of a mansion. Look, Publius, the chief official. He welcomed us into his home, kind of, you know, he has visions for me of Tony Blair staying at the home of Barry Gibb, one of the Bee Gees in Florida, where he is at the moment. He's being welcomed into a nice mansion near the beach. And that's what they were for a few days into that official residence. They were very honourable. Verse 10, they honoured us in many ways, these people. And then eventually they were ready to set sail, and off they did when the spring came round. So they weren't savages, they were very kind people. But these natives, they also show signs of what we could also call the religion of the natural man. That's what I want to focus on this morning. The religion of the natural man. They hadn't heard the gospel before, as far as we know. But the Lord worked to bring via the storm these Christians to this island. But here are these Maltese people, and they're already religious. They have some ideas as to what's right and what's not. They are naturally religious. They built a religion. They built a sense of morality based on their conscience, based on the natural world, based on what they'd heard, based on their own thirsting and searching for more, a sense of right and wrong, a sense of justice. They built a sense of religion. And that is what was operating on this island. But what I want to say is, the natural man then on the island of Malta, those 2,000 years ago, and the natural man today, because people are still building a sense of natural religion, aren't they? Based on their own conscience, based on the world, based on nature. People are doing it all around the world. That natural religion is full of misconceptions. It was then, and it is today. Things that they assume to be true. If I can put it like this, lines on the playing field. Every football pitch has got to have lines. And you must stay within certain lines to be in the game. And natural religion draws lines in places that are not right. I want to pick out three in particular from this passage and show their relevance for us today. The first one is by far the most common of the three I want to pick out. The first one, then. Natural justice always catches up with people in this life. That's what they thought, isn't it? Natural religion kind of believes that. That justice will always catch up with people in this life. That's what verse 4 was all about. They see Paul with this snake in his hand. They see the snake with its teeth in, with its poison, its venom. And so they say to each other, verse 4, look, this is the islanders to one another. This man must be a murderer. For though he escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live. They operate this kind of natural code in their thinking. For them, we know that they've named a goddess after that natural code. Look at the word justice in verse 4. You'll see it's got a capital J. They had a goddess they called Justice. And she ruled the oceans. And she oversaw the lives of human beings. And if somebody did wrong, if they were a murderer, if they stole from the neighbor, if they raped somebody, if they did something wrong, then justice, capital J, this goddess of the skies, she would eventually catch up with you and you would pay for your crime in this life. They envisaged these kind of heavenly beings that were behind natural events. If you'll permit me to put it like this, they kind of had an ancient celebrity big brother. That's exactly what it was. Just as ordinary people watch what goes on in a celebrity house, so-called, of C or D-list celebrities kind of talking about how they view the universe. So they stepped back and watched as they thought the celebrity gods and goddesses playing out their events in the world. That's what they did. And they thought that this goddess Justice was the one that had driven this snake to get to Paul, because he must have been a murderer, he must have been a criminal. And so Justice was getting its own back on Paul. I suppose it hadn't taken them long to work out who was who amongst this landing party. Roman soldiers, they could clearly see because of their uniforms. The prisoners, they could clearly tell because some of them were in chains and certainly they were under guard. So pretty soon, they would have worked out that Paul was a prisoner. He was some kind of criminal. They perhaps didn't know what. They didn't know what his crimes were. But if a snake was going to kill him, if he'd escaped a shipwreck but he was going to die by venom, then surely he must have been a notorious prisoner. And they formed this view of him, that Justice had caught up with him. He'd finally got his comeuppance. This viper in his hand was carrying out natural justice. And they had expectations. Verse 6, even though the snake fell off and that Paul was okay for a little while, verse 6, they've got these expectations. The people expected him to swell up or suddenly fall dead. Because justice has to operate, doesn't it? Natural justice always catches up with people in this life. That was their expectation. That's natural justice. That's natural religion. There are many, many people around the world that believe that, aren't there? This morning. Many people. I'm not just talking about remote island communities. Not just talking about jungle tribes that have not been reached. But many people in our own nation, in the Western world, in Britain today, they believe that. That natural justice just comes back and works in your life, in this life. We may not have given it a goddess name, but many people believe it. Another variation of it we might call karma. People say it, what goes around comes around. If you sow hatred, one day you'll reap it. If you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword. They mistake and use in this context. Those who break the rules will eventually come foul of them. They'll take your lives somehow, a sea, either the sea or a storm or the viper or something. People say you can't cheat the system. Eventually life will catch up with you. These are the kind of ideas and phrases that loiter around this kind of thinking. As though Mother Nature is somehow the judge, the moral arbiter over our lives, over our issues of ethics and morality. They say life has got fairness built into it. However deep it may be, and however unseen at times, there's kind of a fairness, a karma, and natural justice will eventually punish all that abuse it. I want to say that that thinking is quite wrong, isn't it? There's no such thing as Mother Nature. I hope you don't use that word. There's no such thing as Mother Nature. Not at all. There is a set of natural laws that God has put in place. Jonathan tells us that's why he went into science. He told us that in his interview, didn't he, last year? It's why he went into science. He likes the way that the laws work, and he wants to see God behind those. There's a set of laws in place that God has put. Things like gravity, that tends to always work at the same speed. The speed of light. Light always tends to fly at exactly the same speed. Like the water cycle of water going up and across and down and back. And there are these natural laws at work in the world. But there's no Mother Nature. There's no collective consciousness of the natural world, is there? Gravity doesn't assess your soul, does it? These storms that we've been having for the last couple of days, we're not having those storms to pay us back for overeating at Christmas, are we? You know, it rained on my house, nearly blew my roof off because I had too much Christmas pudding. That's not natural justice. There's no Mother Nature. There's no moral arbiter like that at all in the universe, is there? There's no natural court where our lives are assessed and judged. These islanders had it completely wrong. And so do people today who think that. We don't see natural justice in this life. Not often, do we? Sometimes we do. I know Saddam Hussein has. He's now seen justice, hasn't he? And his life was taken from him yesterday as a result. It's very interesting that in Margaret Beckett's statement yesterday, our foreign secretary, on behalf of our government, she said that our government are not in favour of capital punishment, which we know they're not. But she did say, despite that, that the government recognized that justice had caught up with Saddam for his crimes against humanity. And she said, and I'm quoting, "He has been held to account." Our world wants that. It shows that we want to be held to account. We want it, don't we? But for most people, they escape this in this life. Most people do. If our confidence is like these islanders in this kind of natural justice, then we will be disappointed. The Christian worldview is entirely different. We know that the world around us is not the real world. We know that the things that we see are temporary and will pass away. We know that all the powers that dish out justice, they are all temporary and they're all flawed. We know that the invisible world is the real world. The invisible world is the eternal world. And it's in the invisible world where God is. God is eternal. Everything else is passing away. God is eternal, and God is the one that hands out true justice. So justice is invisible, not visible. Justice is eternal in the hands of God, not in this temporary world that will soon pass away. Sometimes in time, God shows us justice, doesn't he? To keep us all from gross sin. And always he appoints secular powers to impose restraints upon us within the rule of law. But true justice is invisible, eternal, and not immediate. These islanders had it wrong. Justice doesn't always come to people in this life. And that makes it far more scary, not less, I want to say. Justice is not less scary because we might dodge it for some years in this life. No snake is going to pay you back for not paying all your taxes or for claiming benefits when you shouldn't. No snake is likely to pay you back for parking on a double yellow line over Christmas. But God will assess every soul. And that is far more scary than ever any wrong misconception of natural justice that these islanders and that people have today. And we must account for that at the end of this year. And end the year with a conscience clean before an almighty God of true justice. Is there any better thing to do tonight, seeing the new year in, than to make sure your conscience is clean before him on all matters? Every single matter. Not just of how we've lived in 2006, but of everything we've ever done. Is there anything more pressing for us to do than make sure our conscience is clean before a new year begins? We need to do that in the court of God, through Christ, not in the court of natural justice. Here's a second misconception. It's related to the first. People who cheat natural justice must be divine or acceptable to God. That's what they go on to think, isn't it? Verse 5, Paul shakes off the snake. He suffers no ill effects. Was this a miracle? Well, I think it quite probably was. Quite probably God has spared him, and it's a miracle. Verse 6, they're waiting for him to swell up or drop down dead. And then when he doesn't, verse 6, look what it says. Seeing nothing unusual happen to him, they change their minds. Here's natural justice at work again. Their natural religion, and they say he's a god. He's cheated natural justice, so therefore he must be over and above natural justice, so he must be divine, acceptable to God, on a kind of a higher moral plane. You see, these islanders, these natives, they didn't have the same view as we do about God from the Bible, but they knew about divines. They knew about divine beings, and their divine beings, they were above us in power and in moral uprightness. And they linked those two. So that if you showed that you had power that was above the norm, you also had morality that was above the norm. That's what they believed. There was this link between the two. You show extraordinary power. You are able to do a miracle. And it shows that you are, well, either a god or you're right with God yourself. That's natural religion at work. It's a huge mistake. It misses the whole thought of this world being a conflict between two powers. We're talking about it with the children. A conflict between two powers at work. The whole of human affairs through 2006 has been a battleground, hasn't it? Between Christ and the serpent. Everything that's happened this year has been a battleground. In the minds of the children, in the minds of the adults, in world affairs, in our lives, in this church. Everything that's happened has been a battleground between Christ and the serpent. There are two kinds of powers, aren't there? One which is absolute in God and is morally pure and undefiled, but one which can be worked through fallen human beings who themselves are not divine, they're sinful. They're flawed. They need forgiveness. But God works his power sometimes through them. And then the other power, utterly defiled, worked by the powers of darkness, but sometimes impressively, Satan doing his work. And there's no moral superiority to his power at all. The link is not right, is it? Power, therefore, must mean morally acceptable to God. Satan has power. But he's repugnant. He smells. He's cast out. Never again to be in the presence of God. If we trust our souls to that thinking, our souls will be shipwrecked. Let me give one example to make the case. Tucked away in Exodus 7. Need to turn to this because we're talking about snakes today, aren't we? So here's another example about snakes. Exodus 7. So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and did just as the Lord commanded. Verse 10, that is, of Exodus 7. Aaron threw his staff down in front of Pharaoh and his officials, and it became a snake. That's a miracle of God done through Aaron. The staff became a snake. Pharaoh then summoned the wise men and sorcerers, that's his own gurus, people relying on the powers of darkness. And the Egyptian magicians also did the same things by their secret arts. Each one threw down his staff, and it became a snake. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. So you've got Moses and Aaron, fallen human beings, both of whom, of course, later God's anger was going to burn against, but showing and being used for the power of God. And on the other hand, you've got these dark magicians performing these secret acts of power, sorcerers, called wise men, but with no moral uprightness. God hardened all their hearts. Their miracle was not of God. And God underlines his superiority in that case, doesn't he? By the snake from Aaron's staff swallowing up theirs, as if to show my power is much greater. But you see the point of the example. Here's powers that seem to be similar, but they don't mean that both are acceptable to God. Now, we don't deal with this kind of thinking on a level with miraculous staffs and snakes and sorcerers very often, do we? But we do come across it. We come across this thinking in our world on a lesser level. I'm sure you've heard this. People who have a narrow escape. They were close to death. They nearly have a car accident. Or they're on a motorbike or something. And they get through it. And immediately they say, oh, someone above was watching over me. Or somebody collects something they didn't deserve. And what do they say? God must be smiling on me. He must be pleased with me. I played Monopoly with my 10-year-old nephew on Boxing Day. You don't play it with a board anymore. If you're cool, you play it with a Nintendo DS, you know, a dual screen. There's no board, there's no counters. It's all 3D graphics. And you do it on the screen. He whooped me completely, which is very embarrassing. And he was the one that got the card, bank error in your favor. Collect $200. See, people get an error in their favor and they say, oh, God must be smiling on me. That's this thinking. I've escaped something. I've got something I don't deserve. Oh, God must be pleased with me. Or somebody's in remission for cancer. The treatment has got it all. And so they conclude, God has been good to me. I must be okay with him. He must be pleased with me because I've had something good. As if God looks after his own and shines the sun only on the righteous. Which of course he does shine the sun on the righteous. But the Bible makes it clear that he shines the sun also on the unrighteous. Just as he reigns on the righteous and he reigns on the unrighteousness as well. God has been good to us. But it's not true that when we escape natural justice, we are de facto right and acceptable to God. It's not true. In his patience, God has spared us all in 2006 in so many ways, hasn't he? He's spared us from many disasters. He's given every one of us here this morning extra time to repent and get right with him before the year is out. He's given it to all of us. He's kept us from harm. He's given us opportunities. He's granted us so much grace. But just because he's done things for us doesn't mean that we're spiritually acceptable to him where we sit. Doesn't mean that, does it? They thought Paul was a god. It's like what happened to him in chapter 14 in Lystra. You remember when they bowed down before him and Paul tore his clothes and said, I'm not a god, I'm a mere man like you. God doesn't work like this in the world. He doesn't. God is not like men who does favors for his friends but charges strangers the full price. God doesn't do that. That's not what it's like. Every one of us is faulty and guilty before him. We're in need of saving grace, redeeming grace. Only Jesus Christ makes us acceptable to God. Nobody else. Not what we do, not the way we live, not the good we do, not however spectacular the deliverance is. None of that makes us acceptable to God. That's natural religion. It's wrong. We need Christ. That's the message of the Bible. The third misconception comes out of this passage. It's not in it, but it comes out of this passage, and it's this. You may think this is a bit strange, but let me make the point. Playing with snakes or believing in universal healing somehow shows that you've got God on your side. That's the misconception that comes out of this passage. You may say this is a bit of a silly point, but I do need to make it. You know, in the United States, there's a whole denomination based on the spectacular practice of handling snakes in churches. You know that, right? There's about 100 churches, and they call themselves evangelicals in the States. And the name of the denomination is the Church of God with Signs Following. That's their name. And they believe in a strictly literal interpretation of the Bible. Along with this incident in Acts 28, when Paul has the snake and doesn't die from it, they add in a couple of other scriptures, mainly two. Mark 16 they add in, that goes like this, Mark 16 verse 17. And these signs will accompany those who believe. In my name they will drive out demons, they will speak in new tongues, they will pick up snakes with their hands, and when they drink deadly poison it will not hurt them at all. They will place their hands on sick people and they will get well. And to that they add Luke 10. And verse 19, which goes like this. I have given you authority to trample on snakes and scorpions and to overcome all the power of the enemy. Nothing will harm you. So to those two passages, they add in Acts 28, where Paul overcame this snake, and they want to live them out. And they sound very, very clear. Let me read to you the quote of one of them. I feel like the Lord is leading me now to find a church where they worship in the old time way, where they preach the full gospel. In this day and age, there are so many churches that believe most of the Bible, but they cut parts out. We'd agree with that statement, wouldn't we? They don't believe the end of the book of Mark, where Jesus said you will drink poison and not be harmed and tread on serpents, and that God will protect you, that the Holy Spirit will be in you. We've got to believe all of the Bible. We'd believe that a little bit. Jesus said that even greater miracles we can do than he did, and I think that includes the demonstration of our faith before God with serpents and poison. So they believe that, they take it literally, and what they do is they have their snakes and they bring them out. They wheel them out in church on a Sunday, always behind the pulpit. Interesting. You've got to come up to the front behind the pulpit. You handle these rattlesnakes and these cobras and these other kinds of snakes, and they drink poison, usually strychnine. And they handle fire, and it kills some of them. There are 60 recorded deaths in this denomination. Death by snake handling. The founder himself, George Hensley, died in 1955 of a snake bite. One of the pastors is even doing time in prison because the prosecutors have proven that he used a snake to try and murder his wife in church because he didn't like her. So he welcomed her up to handle the snake and gave her the poisonous snake. She got bit, and he's doing time in Alabama jail for attempted murder. And of course, just a couple of months ago, I've got the report here, in Kentucky, a lady died in one of the churches. It's tragic, really. Her name was Linda Long. She didn't live long because she was bitten in church by a snake. It's tragic, really. So misled and so tragic. But they take passages like this and they say, well, if we can overthrow natural illness, we don't go to doctors. These people don't believe in doctors. If you get bitten by a snake, you don't go to the hospital or a doctor. You try and lay hands on yourself and heal. They don't go to doctors for anything. They believe in universal healing. Didn't work for the 60. And they believe that handling snakes shows that they are overcoming the evil one. What's their thinking in doing this? Where's their misconception? Well, they get to it like this. They think that every snake is the incarnation of a demon. And so in handling the snake without being bitten, they say that they're having power over the demon in the name of Christ. And when the snake bites you, that shows you have lack of faith, or the Spirit's not really upon you, or God is disciplining a transgressor. Friends, it's a false way of thinking. It's not natural. This kind of literal reading of the Bible is not what the Bible was intended for. In the same passage in Luke chapter 10, it says that none of them should take a spare tunic when they travel, but they all do that. It says, don't take a bag or a purse or a pair of sandals when you travel. That was Christ's command to the disciples when they went out, when he used this phrase about the snakes. But they don't apply that part. They all do that. They're taking the Bible literally, but not universally so. And they're taking it out of context. Of course, there are signs that follow true believers. But the signs, my friend, are holiness and Christ-likeness. That's the sign that people will see in 2007. If you're a true believer, people must see holiness. They might never see you handle a snake, but they must see holiness. If they don't see holiness in you, or holiness in me, if you don't learn to speak more like Christ and less like yourself, and if I don't do that, how will they ever know we've come from God? How will they ever know that we're not just pushing natural religion like some other wackos? The signs must be likeness to Christ. Will people see that in your life this year? Will they see that more and more and more as the months go on? Will your family see it? Will your children see it? Will your neighbors see it? We must be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. We've been commanded. They understand Scripture wrongly when they take it like this. They trust God wrongly. We should trust God to make us into the image of Christ through everyday events in life, not this kind of wacky presumption of trying to put ourselves in the place of danger in order to prove it. And their view of the miraculous is wrong. Notice, of course, that Paul, when he's in the chief official's house, somebody is sick there, verse 8, his father. So Paul is able to heal him after prayer and laying on of hands. And verse 9, the sick of the island come and were cured. And of course, they miss that Paul was given specific and unique apostolic authority and gifting over sickness to authenticate that he was a messenger of Christ and that his message was truly of Christ. Just as Christ healed in order to authenticate his authority, so Paul was doing the same. This is not universally applicable. We believe God heals. We know it. We've seen it. But it's not universally applicable. And every believer does not have the power to heal every sickness and every person they come across. We must pray and humbly ask God to heal where he will and to not where he won't. They take the Bible out of context. But before we let ourselves off the hook on this point, we snakeless church, and long may it remain so. Before we let ourselves off the hook, let me just say that again, this attitude creeps in amongst Christians and churches in all kinds of ways, doesn't it? People that have faith when they're not acting sensibly. Is that ever you? You do outrageous things that are not wise, not thought out, not God-honoring. And then you seek to have faith. Say, well, it'll be okay. God will watch over me. That is not the Christian life, but it creeps in all over the place. I know Christians who don't put their seatbelts on and they say that God will protect them. That's not right. I know Christians who do put their seatbelts on and pray before every journey and then drive like absolute nutcases, ignoring all the traffic lanes, the rules, the speed limits, the highway code and everything. That's not right. I know Christians who are sloppy at work. They pray every week for God to make them a witness at work, but then they're not diligent. They don't follow the rules. They don't honor the boss. They don't do things well. They cut corners. They upset people. They ride roughshod over people and pray that God will make them a witness at work. My friend, that's the same kind of thinking. They say, well, it'll be all right in the end because God wants them there as a witness. Of course he wants you there to be a witness, but not working like that. We don't think that God is on our side in some extraordinary way, apart from the ordinary things of life. We must seek to humbly, graciously, and sensibly live in this world in 2007. Not just seeking and craving the spectacular and extraordinary. We must pray for God to use us with his grace at work in our lives. With a gospel-centered message. With a Christ-like holy life. That's true religion. Not natural religion. Not wacky snake religion. Will you live 2007 with that as your guiding principle? That is what will show to the world around us that the grace and the power of God is at work in human lives, in yours and in mine. That is what the world needs to see. That is what our neighbors need. And that is what we need more and more, the grace of God, not misconceptions of natural religion. May God make that plain to us and to everybody around us.